Hello, everybody. That's what Kate Smith used to always say on the radio.
Why don't you tell people who is Kate Smith? Because they don't know.
Kate Smith
I
was
barely know.
a great American. No, she actually used to sing, like, America the Beautiful was her signature song.
Right. This was in the much olden times.
Yes, in like the 30s and 40s. Yeah, she was a big deal,
She was a big star. She was a big
she was a
star.
big star and a big lady.
She was also a big lady,
Yes.
yeah. And her catchphrase was, "Hello,
Hello, everybody.
everybody."
She
Because
was
back then,
You
there
didn't
was
need
not a
much for
lot
a
of competition going around for catchphrases.
catchphrase. Like,
You could just say any kind of thing, and if you said it enough times, it became your
Your
catchphrase.
catchphrase could be, "Well, hello there," or "Here I am."
What's for supper?
Yeah. And there was an attempt to turn her into a movie star in a movie called
Hello,
Hello, Everybody.
everybody.
And it did not go so well.
Well, yeah. Do you think they'll ever show it on TCM?
I wish.
I've never seen them show it on TCM.
It
And
turned
maybe
up.
we missed it.
It no, I think I've got it in TiVo actually. It turned up at a there's an event they do at the Egyptian once a year that's like super hardcore, like film archivists and collectors, and you know, where they show fairly obscure stuff. And they screened that, but I
Yeah, we
couldn't,
were
like,
out of town or
well, no,
something
you had
when
to
it
have like
happened.
you had to have a this like a pass for the whole event to go. You couldn't just get a ticket for that one
Oh,
movie.
really?
Yeah.
That's not my memory, but.
Yeah, it was a Paramount title at the time. But if you go on YouTube, you can see the.
Oh, my.
And this is the title of the song, Pickaninny Heaven
It's.
song that she
Oh,
does.
God.
It's a dedication to a bunch of black orphans. And it's the most racist thing
It is the most racist thing
you've ever seen.
I mean, obviously the intention was not to be racist, but that's because back then
Everyone was an idiot.
white people just assumed that everything they did was fine.
Oh, God.
And that I think they I don't know what white people thought back then. It just blows my
Apparently,
mind.
there was a white and exotic, you know, and if you weren't white, it was like, wow, what's that like? No, don't tell me. I'm not really interested. Allow me to show you, allow me to depict what your life is like through my. Anyway. Kate Smith, everybody. She was a big thing.
So I've decided.
This is a podcast of the cinema, by the
Oh
way.
yeah, that's yeah.
I'm Alonzo Duralde, film reviews editor for The Wrap and TV recapper and film reviewer for What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube. And that there is Dave White.
Allow me some agency, please.
You introduce me all the time. I'm just doing it
But that's
this time.
because I need to have agency over you.
Dave White, monologist, memoirist,
My monologist.
muckraker, and mummenshans.
I'm a film critic for therap.com, is
That's
what I am.
true. That's true. You have been up late.
Just turned in my latest one the other day, and apparently there are all kinds of comments. I have not been looking at them because I
Yes.
don't care.
It is inevitable.
But I've decided something
What's that?
based on one of those comments. You are not satisfactory to me anymore because you are not full of lesbians and gratuitous nudity.
It's true. I have failed you on that front.
So I'd like you to go out and become full of lesbians and gratuitous nudity so that I may become happy to look at you.
Yes. According to a commenter on the Wrap, Dave didn't like God's Not Dead 2 because it didn't have lesbians and gratuitous nudity.
I didn't look at this comment. This was told unto
I'm
me.
sure this guy thinks a lot about lesbians and gratuitous nudity.
Spake mine husband.
No, it never fails when
My gay husband.
you are reviewing an agenda-driven film and you don't like the film, everybody jumps to the conclusion that it's because you don't like the agenda. Whether you're viewing a Christian movie,
Admittedly, I didn't like either agenda
well, true.
or film.
But not liking the movie means that you are, of course, in the tank because you are a godless heathen liberal. Blah 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 blah. My favorite, of
That
course,
movie's a lot of blah, blah, blah,
no
blah.
kidding. My favorite of those was the person who told me that I was too gay to appreciate Les Miserables,
The
the
musical.
musical. Please walk me through that one, commenter, because I don't know what you're talking about.
Excuse me, but have you met Alonzo Duralde? Favorite musical is 1776. Other favorite musical is Godspell. Complete weirdo.
I have other
Absolute gay for musicals.
favorites. Those two just happen to come attached to holidays that make them an annual,
Yeah, they do. Annual viewing
Hey,
for both.
you watch White Christmas every year.
That's different. It's a delight. Godspell is weird and irritating. And 1776 admittedly is a good film, but it's about 5 hours long.
We just lost two 1776 cast members, by the way.
Ken Howard and who?
And James Noble, who
Oh, that's
played
right.
Josiah Bartlett, I believe,
Yeah.
but is best known for having played the governor on Benson, both passed away in the last couple of weeks.
Right.
And of course, the big loss of the week, which we have to talk about,
Yeah.
is Patty Duke.
Patty Duke.
Academy Award winner Patty Duke.
This one made me sad.
Yeah, me too.
Because she didn't have to die. She died of sepsis. Do you know what that is?
No.
It's like this bacteria infection gone wild.
And why did it?
It happens to you sometimes in hospitals.
Yeah, no, I mean, I know the
Yeah.
name, but weird. And I mean, was she like just not near a medical
I
facility at the
don't
time,
know.
or
I don't
that's such
know.
a random thing to
It is a
die?
random thing to die of.
Oy. But she obviously won an Academy Award for playing Helen Keller in The Miracle Worker, and then later played Annie Sullivan in a later TV made for TV version of The Miracle Worker.
Yeah.
Starred in the wildly popular The Patty Duke Show, where she played identical twin cousins,
Yes.
because that happens.
A hot dog makes her lose control.
Yes. Who could forget? And of course, most importantly, for my purposes, she was Neely O'Hara
She'll always be
in
Neely
the immortal
O'Hara.
1967 film version of Valley of the Dolls, which is, say what you want about that performance.
No, say what you want about that movie. Her performance is astounding.
She is not holding back.
Yes.
That is, she is.
She gives a performance in that movie that is on par, and I mean this in the best possible way,
With Elizabeth Berkeley and Showgirls.
and Faye Dunaway in Mommy Dearest. These are performances by women that go outside of the boundaries of what most people consider to be acceptable wildness.
Sure.
And when an actress commits that hard to a part that calls for that kind of wildness, then people get upset for some reason. And it doesn't matter if it's in a good or bad film. There can be a bad performance in a good film and a good performance in a bad film. And those three films, regardless of what you think about their quality or how they relate to the world, of cinema, those three performances are, to me, astonishing.
There are certainly ones that I
You
find myself,
never forget them.
I go back and watch them a lot.
Yeah.
So there's obviously something
'Cause you're trying to
there.
figure them out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I really believe that when men do this, they get nominated for an Oscar.
Right.
When Leonardo DiCaprio grunts his way through a movie,
Yeah.
he wins an Academy Award.
True. And these women are basically will be impersonated by drag queens until the end of time.
Right, which I think is a sort of a badge of honor.
Sure.
But I really believe that these sort of outlier kind of performances that really take a lot out of the actor, And that really sort of burn up when you're watching them on screen. I think that's great. It is, we often reward big acting,
True.
but when the acting is so big that it makes people uncomfortable, all they can do is laugh at it. And they say that it's bad. But I don't think that's true at all. I think it's demanding and it's exuberant and it's, you know, more than maybe you're ready to deal with.
I think also that, and if you read Call Me Anna, which is an amazing memoir in which she talks not only about her career, but also about her ongoing struggles with bipolar disorder. And she was actually really one of the first celebrities to kind of talk about that
She was the
stuff.
first time I've ever heard that word, that thing discussed. I was a kid-ish teenager, I guess, when that book came out.
That was a big deal
Yeah.
when that happened. And co-written by Kenneth Turan, by the way, that
Yeah.
book. But she talks about how what a terrible time that they had with Mark Robeson and how he was not particularly kind to any of the actresses in that movie.
Right.
I think if you had taken all the things that Patty Duke put into that performance and then given her a director to sort of guide it a little more and
Yeah.
shape it a little more,
Right.
then yeah, I think it would have done that little imperceptible pivot to, camp iconography to like just genuinely powerful acting. But yeah, it's I never get bored with it.
No, and it's incredible to watch her do it. And I've seen that movie many times because of you, and also because of my friend Carl, who was the first person to show it to me back in the day. I've seen it a lot, and every time I watch it, not only do I have a great time, but I think every time I see it more and more, I just think she's so cool.
Yep. It's sad. She had just a really fascinating, tumultuous life, and I think really had kind of was in a good place. She'd sort
Oh,
of
yeah.
she'd left the business. She was living out in like Idaho or somewhere like that
Right.
and remarried, and her sons obviously are Sean and Mackenzie Astin.
Right.
But it's a loss. She was a one of a kind stage, film, and TV performer for sure.
Same age as my mom when she died, 69 years old.
It's weird how young that feels as we get older. Like
Well,
when Gary Shandling died, he was 66. You're
yeah.
like, 66? That's
It's
nothing.
because we're
We're
old
yes,
now.
I know. We're staring down the barrel of it all.
We're middle-aged Generation X dummies.
Yep, pretty much.
Well, okay. I'm a dummy. You're going to Carlo
Whatever.
Vivari.
I'm whatever.
Speaking of whatever, we watched God's Not Dead 2.
And I love seeing these movies with you because you annotate.
Oh, I gotta.
Yeah. Because I was not raised Protestant and certainly not
It's
evangelical.
yeah. There's a whole bag of difference between Protestant and what I came up
Right,
with.
I know, but I'm saying
Yeah.
I so I'm several root.
Technically, I was raised Protestant.
Sure.
That brings to mind kindly Lutherans in Minnesota on a Lake Wobegon episode. And or those starchy, uptight Episcopalians who are so like liberal, and now all the Episcopal churches are like peace and justice and, you know, all the
Well,
lefties.
except for the ones that, the ones that want to ban gay people or whatever,
Well, yeah, them. What do the kids call it? Problematic.
Yes,
Those
exactly.
people are problematic.
But anyway, so when I see a movie like God's Not Dead 2, I mean, I can I, there's an obvious agenda at play here and an obvious sort of dramatic structure that's, designed to, take you to a certain place, but you're always pointing out things that I would have completely missed otherwise.
Well, because it's these films, in spite of the fact that this was released on well over 2,000 screens nationwide, that is only happening because the first one which was made for approximately 37 cents, grossed over $60 million right. at the box office. It is also the first film, God's Not Dead. It is also an ineptly made film, irredeemable piece of trash.
Yes.
That does not actually deserve the right to be called a Christian film, because it is truthfully just one of the most hateful and cruel cinematic experiences I've ever witnessed.
That is a movie that is dripping with spite.
Yeah.
For anyone who is not on board for everything they have to offer.
It is the mean, it is, I mean, it really takes the prize. It is the meanest Christian film I've ever seen, and I have seen a good chunk of them.
And you saw See Me Dance.
See Me Dance is adorable. See Me Dance.
Yes, but See Me Dance has people turned into fundamentalists by being touched.
See Me Dance. Please, you guys, go find See Me Dance. Now it's spelled the
letter C.
C, the letter C, like in cancer, which is what the film is about. Ish. See Me Dance. It will blow your widow mind.
That's a movie that, it's a Christian movie that even a lot of Christians were like,
what?
You know.
Like, the Christian audiences who saw that movie were like, I don't understand what they were trying to do with that movie. It is so wild and so out of control and so built on weird, like, supernatural elements and
a very specific
demon fighting
subset of theologies.
Yeah. It is wacky. That's the best word to describe it. That is not the same thing as God's Not Dead.
No.
God's Not Dead is just awful and just mean. Mm. Briefly, it is the first film was about a college kid who's Christian who goes to his very first philosophy class taught by an atheist professor. Played by Kevin Sorbo, an actor's actor.
You need a marquee name in your movie, and you'll take literally anyone,
right? You get Hercules, television's Hercules.
Yes.
The kid then spends the rest of the movie coming up with a debate for the professor. They're going to debate the existence of God, because the professor on day one says, you will write the words God is dead on a piece of paper and you will hand it in to me or you will fail this class. Now, first of all, that does not happen.
Yeah, secondly, that's not how academia works.
secondly, the idea that you can debate someone on the existence of God is a fool's errand. Faith is about what you cannot see, about what you don't have empirical proof for.
The ineffable.
It's not up for debate. You either believe in God or you don't. And if anyone asks you why, it's kind of hard to trot out a lot of factual-based information on why you do.
Not if you're the makers of the God's Not Dead series.
Exactly. So, here's why the first God's Not Dead movie is so gross. Anyone in the film who is not a believer is never sort of benign. They are actively anti-theist. They are filled with literal hate for Christians and for God. And so they must be destroyed. And they are. even if they convert, they still get killed, they still get terminal illness.
And they all deep down believe in God enough that they hate him.
Right.
Actively as a thing that exists.
Yeah.
Which is not how atheism works.
Right. So that's that piece of garbage.
Now it's Piece of Garbage 2.
Piece of Garbage 2. Which
The
is
Quickening.
A better film.
From a
technical standpoint,
where the camera is placed,
yeah,
yes, sure.
It's better directed, it's better shot, it's better acted. They have actual actors in this film this time because the first one made so damn much money that they said, "Hey,
let's spend
some money on some actors." You know, the best actor in God's Not Dead was Dean Cain. Television's Superman.
Let that sink in.
This time around, they have Melissa Joan Hart. Laugh at her all you want as a human being. But she, you know, she's capably sympathetic as this person.
She's okay.
You feel sorry for her in this movie.
Her pout needs work, and she has to do a lot of it in this movie.
I know. It's also got Jesse Metcalf from Desperate Housewives. Mm-hmm. He is as good an actor as Melissa Joan Hart.
Sure.
Yeah.
He's no Ryan Guzman.
We'll get to him in a minute.
I know.
Who else is in this?
Ray Wise. Best thing in the movie.
Ernie Hudson.
As the snidely whiplash of attorneys.
Yeah. So Melissa Joan Hart is an Arkansas high school teacher who, in the course of teaching a history lesson about Martin Luther King Jr. and Gandhi.
And nonviolent resistance.
Yes. She talks about how the roots of King's nonviolence philosophy come from Jesus.
In answer to a question,
a student actually asks this question, and she gives this answer. It is a factual answer.
Yeah, she refers to the authors of the Gospels.
Yeah.
She never says anything about, like, the Word of God or anything like that. It's a very kind of straightforward, you know, Jesus is said to have said this, King was inspired by it, da-da-da-da. Like, any history class, you could have this answer, and it's a
reasonable answer. No one's going to bat an eye. No eyebrow raised.
Not in this universe,
but in this fantasy world of
Christian persecution,
atheistic Arkansas.
Yes.
I'm going to annotate right now for our listeners who do not live in the United States. Arkansas is the state equivalent of this.
It is one of several places in the country that would probably claim credit for being the buckle of the Bible Belt.
Yeah, that's Arkansas. Okay, so I lump Arkansas in with Texas, my Texas, where I am from, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana,
Georgia, where I am from.
Georgia. Tennessee, Kentucky, basically
Jesus land.
Florida, the dumbest part of the South, aka
the South.
The South. Plenty of dummies in the North too, but for some reason they all like it be a little warmer. So she gets a lawyer. What's his face from Desperate Housewives?
Jesse Metcalf.
And
he's handsome, as Bobby Hill would say.
He's very handsome. And the ACLU, it is strongly suggested that these lawyers are from the ACLU. Ray Wise shows up and turns on his I killed Laura Palmer face. And says to either Metcalf or Melissa Joan Hart, you know, I hate what you people stand for, and I hate God. Like, he says these things.
And he's just like, we're here to prove once and for all that God is dead. Like,
that is actually outside of the boundaries of your job description at this particular moment.
Like, it was such a great applause line the first time around. They had to figure out how to shoehorn it into this movie, but it's not really relevant at all.
It's not relevant to the case.
Yeah.
But here's the weird part about this movie. Suddenly, the case is no longer about, is this
appropriate for a public school teacher.
A pedagogical, acceptable moment. That's not what the case is about. The case is about, is Jesus real?
Well, and the thing is,
And the judge goes along with this. The lawyers are all arguing about this. And it really blows my mind that they this straw man, this completely ridiculous kind of straw man argument, that they get away with this in the script.
From the moment that she is attacked for this thing and gets into trouble, anyone in the audience with working synapses is like, but wait, in the context of history, in the context of how Dr. King, who was a reverend, was influenced, of course you would talk about Jesus. And, discussing the historic Jesus in no way is proselytizing or a discussion of whether or not he's divine. This movie treats that super logical thought that you had 5 minutes into this movie as the third act reveal. That's the brilliant legal strategy that Jesse Metcalf finally figures out late in the film, and you're like, catch up, Metcalf. We were there an hour and a half ago.
It is not too much to say that any fool walking into this movie can sit down and say, you know what? This is not true. Like, this is, you guys are actually making stuff up right now.
And they make up enough stuff to set up a third movie
Oh, I know.
about how all the preachers now have to turn in their sermons under subpoena because the government can tell you what you can and can't preach, which is not happening in the United States
they cite
as much
the
as these guys would like to
example
believe it
of
does. The mayor of Houston or something.
She did, and it was for an equal rights ordinance for LGBT folks and
Yeah,
the
the council pass or something was trying to pass.
and she withdrew the subpoena because she was like, oh wait, no, I can't do that. And people got, I mean, people did get upset when she did it, but it never happened. Like, no one actually had to
Yeah,
do anything.
so one
like she made this mistake.
Yeah, one overstep, one
I don't
overreaching
know all
politician.
the full details or what why she thought that was a good idea or anything,
But that, of course, means that the government is coming for your religion.
Yeah, and now again, because this thing happened in real life
That didn't even
that
happen.
didn't go anywhere. Now, the film has decided that it's now it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And in the film, in the world of the film, it is going to happen. You stay for the closing credits. You stay after the closing credits. You'll see.
Religious
I'm giving
shawarma.
away all the spoilers here, like. Most of you probably don't care. The guy who plays the pastor in the first movie, David A.R. White is his name. He is the producer of the film. He is also the producer of God's Not Dead. He is also the founding business partner of Pure Flix, which is now a heavy hitter in the world of Christian independent cinema. And he is.
Oh, I was gonna say, is he related to you? Was my question.
Yes. Everyone named David White is related to me.
You and him and the guy who played
Come
Larry
on,
Tate on Bewitched.
I set up the T-ball for
Okay,
you.
well,
Tell me who else he is.
you may know him from the internet meme. Hey, Scotty. Jesus, man.
That was David A.R. White in a young role in a Christian film called Second Glance.
Chance.
Second Chance, Second Glance,
From
whatever.
1992.
When he was about 20, I guess, or 18, or something like that.
And he's
But
still a terrible actor.
yeah, time has not improved his acting skills at all. But he's got the money and the power now, which is the point of God's Not Dead, too. Not so much money, but power.
Because when you hear from the religious right about how Christians are being silenced in the public square and blah, blah, blah. What they're really saying is Christians don't have the public square to themselves anymore the way we used to when, all those other uppity religions knew their place.
There was a time in American cultural life when white Christians didn't have to question the fact that they were the religion of they were the dominant force in religion in the United States. Sure, there were some Jews in New York or Los Angeles or wherever it is they keep the Jews. But and there were, there's some other weird religions off in the big cities maybe too, but everybody just sort of knew that, Christianity, and specifically the Christianity practiced by Middle of the road, white Catholics and Protestants,
Mostly Protestants. The
but mostly Protestants.
Catholics, I think, were also considered as outliers for
Well,
a
no,
long
the
time.
among the kind of, it's so crazy for me to even use the word Protestants. Among the conservative evangelicals with whom I grew up, Catholics were considered not
Oh, I
Christians.
know, but I'm
Yeah.
saying even in the mainstream, like I refer you to John F. Kennedy's
Correct.
presidential campaign.
Yes. They were comfortably in the majority that dominated everything else. That has changed. And now conservative evangelical Christianity is upset that they are no longer merely one voice in American cultural dialogue.
No, that they are no longer the voice in American cultural dialogue.
I'm sorry. Yeah, they're no longer the voice. They're not happy that they are just one voice.
Right.
They want unchallenged domination. That
Yes.
is what they want.
Yeah.
They want to make the rules, they want to make the laws, they want you to live by them. That's a fact. Now, I know plenty of evangelical Christians who do not believe this. They don't like that idea and they don't believe in that stuff. And they are not the audience for this film.
Or the makers.
Or yeah, they're also not the makers of this film.
The makers of this film definitely want that for themselves and for you and for everybody else, whether they like it or not.
The movie can't be honest about its intentions, though.
No. Because
It
you don't get to be a victim and like the head of everything at the same time.
cites all these court cases in the closing credits. They scroll through them real fast. You can't even read them. But they're online. And yeah, there are these court cases that have popped up all around the country about where we will, as a country, draw the line between, public religious expression and religion harassing and persecuting the people who are not part of that religion. Because that's what this is really about. Every one of these cases, pretty much down the line, involves a Christian trying to impose their stuff on everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, like one of lawyer Jesse Metcalfe's big flourishes about how the words the separation of church and state don't actually appear in the Constitution,
Right.
conveniently forgetting the fact that the words that do appear in the Constitution are Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of
Right.
religion. But because those words don't aren't in there, you're not allowed to talk about the separation of church and state.
Right. So, this is when the film decides to bring in its big guns and to completely show its hand.
And dramatically grind to a halt. Not that it was
If
really
you are,
rolling at
if
that
you
point.
see this movie and you get confused during the last third because they're bringing in these witnesses that don't seem to have anything to do with the case and don't seem to be talking about things that are relevant to the case, you're right to be confused. They bring in two guys. These are real guys playing themselves
Yes.
in the film. One of them's his name is J. Warner Wallace, and he is a Los Angeles homicide detective.
Phineas J. Whoopington.
And he became a Christian in the 90s, and he wrote a book called Cold Case Christianity. Which used what he did was for the purposes of this book, he used DNA techniques. He used cold, not DNA, sorry,
No.
bleh. I'm hitting myself in the head. He used cold case investigative techniques to determine for himself whether there was enough real historical, factual, physical evidence for the truth of Christianity. For the resurrection, for the existence and the death and the resurrection of Jesus. Can Christianity be, in his words, evidentially true?
Yeah. So basically, he treats the Gospels as conflicting witness statements
Yeah.
and ties them all together to decide that, hey, what do you know? This must be true.
Yeah. The other guy they put on the stand is a guy named Lee Strobel. Now he is also an author and a pastor, and he too is involved in the world of what's known as Christian apologetics. That's what J. Warner Wallace is about, and that's what Lee Strobel is about. Christian apologetics is... It is not a denomination. It is not a school of thought. It's more like a hobby. I guess, I mean, that's not the right word either, but
like train spotting.
It's kind of a branch of Christian thought that proposes that you can prove the truth of Christianity. Here's the thing about Christian apologetics. It's an interesting dorm room game, but it doesn't solve anything, and it doesn't prove anything. The people who write books about how you can reason your way into faith, how you can sort through real evidence to get to truth about the resurrection of a dead person. They're chasing their tails, honestly.
Well, I'm sure it's designed so you can, like, win arguments with those pesky free thinkers.
Thank you very much for bringing that up. Because that's what this is about. It's about winning arguments. From the time I was young in the evangelical / fundamentalist church, I was surrounded by apologetics type, you know, folks. Mm-hmm. And by books written by those folks. I don't know how far back this stuff goes, but in the 80s, it became a real big deal among Christians. It was always these guys who were into it. Guys who loved to win arguments. Preachers who loved to win arguments. More than one time, more than two times, I saw preachers in the pulpit talk about this kind of, you know, proving the truth of the gospel and contrasting it with a feelings-based faith. And every time they would contrast it with the feelings-based type of faith, they would begin speaking as though they were feminine. As though feelings were the exclusive products, territory of women and homosexuals.
They need hard facts!
Right. Really. Because if you don't have the facts and you cannot win, then you don't have power. And if you don't have power, then you are a loser in the world. Never mind that it actually says in the Bible that Christ made himself powerless.
Right.
Made himself nothing. That doesn't sit well with these guys. So these guys have to go around arguing about the truth of the gospel all the time. And that's what God's Not Dead 2 is about. And that's what God's Not Dead is about. It's about winning and dominating and beating back the non-believers.
Right.
Proving you're right. This movie is garbage.
Yeah, it's dull, and it relies solely upon this ridiculous sort of straw man plot.
As long as conservative evangelical Christians continue with this persecution fantasy, this warlike mentality, they will never be what they think they're being in the world.
They don't seem very Christ-like, because heaven knows in both of these movies, you know, the Christian people are so sweet and kind and loving,
yeah,
and good to their family members and good to the community and placid and smiling, and all the non-believers are so angry all the time.
They're spitting practically when they speak.
No,
yeah,
no,
it's great.
There's no hope, and they're just, and you know, And there's like the Christians do get the smug dialogue about what does Pat Boone say in this movie?
I don't know.
Like,
Blah 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 blah. It's my bedtime.
Something about like, they take away the something, but they also take away the hope,
Pat Boone's in this film, by the way.
As is Robin Givens.
She doesn't have much to do though, except be a mean, principal.
They needed to
Pat
get.
Boone, so groovy in The Cross and the Switchblade. I saw that as a kid in
I'm
church.
sure you did.
That movie was with it, man.
I imagine you growing up with that and The Gospel Road and like
Oh
Eternal
yeah.
Loop.
Oh, I watched The Gospel Road in church too, the Johnny Cash Jesus movie.
Yeah.
That's a good movie.
Whereas my church, they showed us the Pasolini Gospel According to St. Matthew.
You people are going to hell.
Once. Once.
So anyway, there's gonna be a God's Not Dead 3, y'all. Come hell or high water, there's gonna be a God's Not Dead 3. Even if God's Not Dead 2 doesn't do well this weekend or at all in the box office, and it totally will. God's Not Dead 3 is coming. It might go straight to DVD, but it's
Not and
coming.
not only is there going to be God's Not Dead 3, God's Not Dead 3 is going to have a lot of David A.R. White in
Oh
it.
yeah, he'll be the star of this one because
Yeah.
he's already set himself up to be the star of the next one
Yeah.
by this subplot that actually doesn't make any sense because
No.
they don't explain any details of it at all.
No.
They don't even explain why they're being subpoenaed to turn in their services to turn in their sermons.
Oh, this movie is also, I guess, the last screen appearance of Fred Dalton Thompson,
Yes.
who pops up briefly. Yeah, so a lot more David A.R. White, and I guess the next one's going to be another courtroom drama, probably. So, yippee. Watch this
Well, because
space.
that's how you can argue and win arguments.
True.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, did you ever see the play I Hate Hamlet?
No.
The Paul Rudnick play.
No.
It's about this young actor who is haunted by the ghost of this older actor. Or is he haunted by the ghost of Hamlet? I forget. Anyway, the young actor talks about how they ask him what kind of training he had, and he
Right.
goes, "I did the so and so course, act to win." And then these movies are like Christianity to
Right.
win. On a higher note, we saw Everybody Wants Some.
Yeah.
Latest from Richard Linklater. The posters call it the spiritual sequel to Dazed and Confused, which is a fair description.
Yeah, I'd say that's
The
Sorry, I'm getting my cord off the floor
if
here.
you if you were a high school freshman in 1976, which is when Dazed and Confused takes place, then you would be going to college in 1980, which is when Everybody Wants Some takes place.
Yes.
It is August of 1980, the last weekend before classes start, and we meet our hero, who is a baseball player, played by Blake Jenner, who was on Glee during one of those middle seasons.
Right.
And he moves into the baseball house and gets to know his teammates, and they go out looking for ladies, and he meets a girl who he might feel things for.
Yes.
And it is very ambly, low key, not plot driven in that Linklater way, but also in that Linklater way, it's a lot of fun. And the dialogue is good, and the music choices are great, and the period detail is dead on.
Period detail is spot on in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's not a hair out of place.
Yeah.
The clothes are right, the physical world is right. And you don't think about that very much when you think about 1980. It wasn't that long ago. That was 36 years ago.
Yeah.
And everything was different then.
Yeah. Which, yeah, I was thinking about it. 1980 is also when that's when Freaks and Geeks starts,
Right.
which was my freshman year in high school.
Right. I was already halfway through high school by then,
Yeah.
but this is essentially on its surface a film about nothing. But it actually is about male bonding and that cusp
Yeah.
time when you're between You're between stages of your life.
When like everybody who was the hot whatever in their high school, whether it was baseball player or drama kid or newspaper person or whatever, then goes to college and then finds that they're surrounded by all the other hot shots from all the other high schools and they've got to suddenly compete for their place.
Right. The first college I went to Baylor University for one semester. It's a long story as to how I wound up there, but I did. One of the reasons I went there was because it was kind of tough to get in. Private university, small private university. You had to be academically on point to get into that university. The state schools in Texas that I applied to, they were all offering me scholarships, credit hours, but I was like, no, that was too easy. I want to go here. The college that's offering me nothing, but it's tougher to get into. I got it in my head, I had to go. My family, God bless my mom, she scrounged up enough money for that first semester. And I went. And then there was no money for a second semester, so I came home. But while I was there, I was surrounded by the valedictorians of every little Texas town, and the surrounding area. Anybody who wanted to go to a private Baptist college back then, everyone was at the top of their class. So it was in that you were suddenly in this world of people who were all as smart as you were. That was weird. It was real cool though, because you knew you could talk to people and they wouldn't look at you like, duh, 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 you know. Which was sort of a burden in high school, when you're the one actually doing your homework in high school and other people are not, and you're annoyed by that, and they act like they're cooler than you are. You're like, you're wrong. I read a book.
I say I'm not the weirdo here for liking to read books.
Yeah. So yeah, there's that element of the film. The other is this heavy nostalgia on the part of Linklater, because he was a baseball player in college in small town Texas in 1980. Like that was his, he's making a film about what happened to him. And it reminded me a lot of Arnaud Desplechin's My Golden Years, in that it's this middle-aged man looking back on
Well, not literally in this case.
a hazy sort of
Halcyon.
memory. One that's seemingly fairly structureless. Although this film does have take place in roughly three chunks. Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night.
I guess,
The same way that My Golden Years takes place in three acts and an epilogue. It is also similar to My Golden Days in that it is fairly sexist.
Okay, Amy
Like,
Nicholson said that in LA Week. I don't.
hang on.
Okay.
I actually don't really mean that in the worst possible Because these are personal movies, you're in the hands of middle-aged heterosexual guys who are looking back on their time as children, essentially. They're 18, and on the brink of adulthood, and everything that that entailed in terms of how they understood the object of their desire. And what they understood about the object of their desire was breasts. So, yeah, My Golden Years, kind of sexist. This movie, kind of sexist. And
But in an honest way.
appropriately so, because that's what their lives were like back in that moment.
Yeah, I
Their
mean,
understanding, these young men's understanding of women, was minimal. And so the films themselves operate under that blanket of sexual ignorance.
Right. I mean, I didn't see My Golden Years, but for this film, I don't think that the filmmaker is endorsing
No.
the viewpoint, but I think that the viewpoint is an honest one for the characters at the age they are and at the time they existed.
Yes.
So I can't call that sexist. It just to me it seems accurate in depicting certain kinds of people. I don't think the movie is saying, is agreeing with them, on what to think about women.
I believe there might be an element of agreeance in that the Desplechin's female protagonist, the young girl that he's in love with when he's, a teenager. She is less important to the plot than he is. She's a catalyst for his own understanding of himself more than she is her own story. And because of that, the film does sort of champion the male perspective over the female's
Well,
perspective.
sure, but that's
And
but okay, go ahead.
oh, I'm sorry. And here, Linklater is kind of from a film, making perspective, he's kind of remaking the kind of movie that you would have seen in 1980 about boys and girls starting college together.
Maybe,
There's a
but
lot of naked lady in this movie, and there's a lot of half naked and near naked guy in this movie
yeah.
too. And that's relevant as well,
I
I
feel, yeah,
believe.
I mean, I found the movie to be rather homoerotic in that sort of like straight jock bonding way,
Oh yeah, it's a big locker room party.
where none of it is conscious. But I don't think it's fair to call, because look, if you have a story that is from a certain character's point of view, to then blame it for not paying more attention to the female characters or whatever, it's like, well, but it's not, there's a narrator here. There's a specific person who is our entree to this world, and it's his story. So of course it's going to be his story, and that doesn't, it's he's not focusing on women because it's sexist. It's not focusing on women because it's focusing on this guy, and he's the person, he's the point person on this story.
Think about Serge Gainsbourg for a minute.
Okay.
Was he sexist? Hell yes. Was he great? Yeah. So these two things have to also kind of coexist with each other,
Okay, I'm not.
And so I want to be able to say that, yeah, this movie does indulge in that some, and so does My Golden Years, but at the same time, the filmmaking is so good and so exactly what it's supposed to be, that
I understand.
regardless of how we view this unfortunate situation, it's kind of
I
appropriate.
understand what you're saying, but it feels to me like you're criticizing a steak for not being chicken.
I'm not actually criticizing the steak. I'm just saying that this is a quality of the steak
Okay, but I
that
still
some folks are going to be like, eh, about, but
I still think that however the female characters are depicted, and many of them I think are interesting and intelligent and multidimensional.
wait, in this film?
Yes.
Who?
The actress that he has
Okay,
the
you said
relationship with.
many of them.
Okay, fine, one.
One of them.
But I mean, the guys in this movie for the most part have like a couple of discernible attributes, and that's about it. It's a
Well,
we
they're
get
mostly dummies.
well exactly.
And I think the film also lets us know that that's a real thing about them, that
Yes.
most of them are not incredibly bright. I mean,
No.
a couple of them are smart, but yeah.
I mean, to complain that it's sexist, you could also complain that it's not a musical. I don't know. Like
Oh, you're saying that I'm
it's
complaining, and that's where
okay,
you're getting it
fine.
wrong
So
here.
I'm saying the wrong
Yeah.
thing then. But in other words, I just it's an observation that I don't think is relevant to this.
I think it's kind of relevant.
I would compare this
I love
movie.
this movie, by the way.
Okay, yeah, no, I
Yeah.
know. I would actually compare this movie to Masculine Feminine.
Okay.
Just in it being about, sort of young people, some of whom are sort of intellectually curious and excited about being on their own and about being on the cusp of adulthood and all that
Yeah.
kind of stuff, and being largely plotless,
Yeah.
but but aimless in a way that still allows you to kind of drink in the atmosphere and the music and the mores, if you will, of the time. And so I really felt like Linklater really captured that world in the way
Absolutely.
which he does all the time. I mean, like, that's one of his
Absolutely.
strengths,
They got their money's worth out of that choreographer, and they got their money's worth out of the costume people.
Yes,
Because those
definitely.
costume people dug deep and they found the clothes.
Oh yeah, or made them.
And think about this, the cast composed, entirely of actors in their 20s.
Yeah.
People who were born between 1990 and 1995,
Yeah.
for the most part.
Right.
They all danced like they knew how to dance to
Well,
that
yeah,
music,
it's like
like they lived in that
it's
moment.
like when the 90s kids who made Hairspray had to learn how to Madison,
Right.
That's a key thing in doing a period piece is gonna
Right.
follow
But
it though.
that's a farther back period, and it's a stylistically, it's a much more different kind of dancing. Disco dancing elements of it can still be seen today in how people move on the 2016 dance floor.
I suppose.
So to get it really right
Means not doing certain
means not
things,
doing
yeah.
certain things. And so now, if I have a beef with the choreography, it's that everyone's a good dancer suddenly. Like they're all pretty good at dancing. Let me tell you something. You're 18 years old in southeastern Texas in 1980, and you're a heterosexual male.
I feel like
You let the closet gay boys dance with the girls most of the
my
time.
recollection is that everybody was required to have like even if they weren't good dancers,
You had to have a couple
they had a
moves.
couple of moves.
Right.
Yeah,
Yeah.
like Seth Rogen doing the dice shaking in Knocked Up. You had a couple of disco spins. You had to do like a hand over head thing or something that was your thing, and you just sort of stuck with that, Is that all we saw this week?
I can't think. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I need to say about this one. Other than that, its complicated relationship with women is not a reason not to see it.
Absolutely.
Like I say, I feel like it's a weirdly appropriate tone for this film.
Well, I remember I interviewed him for Dazed and Confused, and he said that one of the inspirations for that movie was American Graffiti, and not just for the sort of like, one crazy night structure of it. He said, but also for the fact that when that movie opened in the 70s, it felt like a movie that had been made in 1962.
Correct.
And he wanted Dazed and Confused in 1993 to feel like a movie that was made in 1976. And so you're right, this does often feel like a movie that was made in 1980.
I mean, just the quality of the film itself. I'm sure it was shot digitally, but
Yeah.
it sure doesn't look like it.
Yeah, no, the colors, you're right. That it's that certain that kind of 70s aren't over yet, look of 80. And Sandra Adair, who cut Boyhood and a lot of his other films, edited this one. And again, it's like I think it's harder to find the rhythms of a movie like this where you're not dealing with obvious plot beats, like meandering probably requires an even tighter control in the editing room
I think so
than a
too.
more traditionally structured film, and she's really good at translating his vibe into what the finished product's going to be.
Go see this. It's very cool.
Yes.
I watched John Ford's 1934 film, The Lost Patrol, with Boris Karloff.
Oh.
But these a British troop in World War I that's on a Mesopotamian patrol. That's Iraq
Yes.
now. The weird thing about it is that it's not on a set. It's not in a sound stage.
Were they shooting in Palm
They're
Springs?
outside somewhere, and they're just these sand dunes, and you think, where did they shoot this movie in 1934? What, do they all go to
Palm Springs.
Did they go to Mesopotamia? No, they went out to the sandy dune desert of California and also in Arizona, and they.
And in their off time, they got in some golf.
Well, they had a lot of off time because they could only work a couple hours a day because it was like 120 degrees where they were. And at least one of the actors got, maybe one of the producers, got sunstroke working on the film. So, yeah, they could only work a few hours every day or else they would die. And so it is a really sad, tense story, and it's been remade many times over the years in different settings.
A lot of John Ford films did. Like, yeah. There's actually a, like, The Informer. There's a blaxploitation remake of.
Yeah.
I forget what it's called.
I've got The Informer in TiVo waiting to be watched.
Oh, cool. Okay, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and Three Godfathers, obviously.
Yes. Which,
you
know. Yeah. This is an interesting movie in that, in particular, the Boris Karloff character, because he plays the doctor of the troop, but he's also devoutly religious, and he loses his mind by the time the film is over, and is, you know, turning the other guys against him because he's so one note about telling them how much they must have faith and stop being drunkards and stuff like that.
Was this before or after Frankenstein?
After, just 3 years after. And so that's, I mean, you know, it's weird, you know, when you're so associated with one character.
True.
Anytime anyone sees you from that point on, you're like, oh, he's the monster. You know, you're, it's,
people coming on the street, fire bad.
Yeah. No, it's, I've seen a couple of the earlier John Ford films that feel like he's finding his way in the world of sound film because he made so many silence.
Right.
And so many silent films that are lost.
Oh, yeah.
That no one will ever see again. That, you know, by the time this comes around, and this, I think, is the same year as the one I watched before with Will Rogers and Step and Fetch It.
Oh, right.
Judge,
that one, we talked about it.
I'm blanking on the name.
What was the crazy racist thing in this movie? I caught part of it.
Oh, one of the soldiers talking about how the women in the South Seas,
they looked white to us.
They looked, yeah. The longer you knew them, the whiter they looked.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah. And, but the idea of futility and hopelessness in war becoming more and more palpable as the film goes on and more of the cast dies until there's only like one guy left. And
it's like that Monty Python joke, like it's the memorial to remember the men who died to keep China British.
Yeah. So I recommend this one. If you get a chance, it's on TCM, I guess, from time to time. It's called The Lost Patrol. It's short, too. It's 70-ish minutes long. It's 73, 74 minutes long.
Judge Priest.
Judge Priest. Thank you. And the signature sort of visual stuff of John Ford, the inventive camera work that, you know, he gets his cinematographers to deal with. You see a little more of that this time around. And so,
well, and obviously if he's shooting in the desert, that's kind of presaging his whole sort of Monument Valley man and nature kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right? So,
yeah. Cool. Yeah. Really good. You ever find it? I got it on TCM. So that's where you'll most likely see it.
Cool. What's your DVD pick this week?
There's a Chantal Ackerman box set.
Yes.
It's coming out. It's already out?
It's already out.
Coming out.
It's already out. From Icarus.
The director of Jean Dielman, These are her some of her other films: From the East, South, From the Other Side, and Down There. And there's a bonus feature, a 2010 documentary about her called Chantal Ackerman From Here.
And the set is called Chantal Ackerman Four Films.
Four films,
Four Films.
yeah. And I'm excited because I haven't seen any of
Oh,
these,
all right.
and they're doing a big retrospective of her work here in Los Angeles right now,
Yeah, I think in New York also.
and in New York. And they're like, some of it's going to be at CineFamily, some of it's going to be at Red Cat,
But they're
some of
showing
it's
everything.
they're showing like everything. And we're going next Saturday
Yeah, to
to
see
see
Golden 80s.
Golden 80s, which is her musical from the,
Set in a mall.
yeah, made in 1980 something or
80, I think,
Yeah.
maybe, yeah.
Very excited about
I
that.
know, I can't wait. My DVD pick this week is The New Age, which is a film that I have been dying to get on DVD for ages. I still have my laser disc because it was never released on DVD, and now finally it is in one of those, like, what they call MOD, manufactured on demand. So, like, they don't make it until you buy it. But this is the Michael Tolkin, who is best known as the author of the novel and the screenplay for The Player. Also directed two, I think, really fascinating films that say a lot about the things that people turn to in moments of crisis. One of them is The Rapture, where Mimi Rogers plays a hedonistic woman who gives herself over to a fundamentalist religion and is
That is such a good movie.
convinced that the world is ending, which is an amazing, amazing movie. And then the other one is The New Age, which stars Judy Davis and Peter Weller as a couple who pretty much lose everything and open a store on Melrose. And that's about
Back when that was a cool thing to do.
yes, exactly, in the 1990s.
There's a stretch of Melrose now where it's cool to have a shop,
Yeah.
but they had theirs on the
Wrong part.
Wrong part. Well, for today at least.
It's basically about people turning to sort of consumerism as an attempt to, fill the void in their life. And just smart and merciless and brilliant and
Very funny.
two great lead performances. Peter Weller is astonishing in this movie, and Judy Davis is always great. Can't recommend The New Age enough. If you've probably never seen it, because it got a very dump release in the 90s when
Yeah.
Warner Brothers had it. And then, like I said, it's never been on DVD before. Doesn't show up on TV that much either. So this is a rare opportunity to see a great neglected movie. And this is when one of the things why I believe in physical media. Because so many titles, they are never available, or they're available briefly, or they're on Netflix for 2 seconds and then they go away. But like you have a chance to have a hard copy of this movie and always have it if it happens to disappear again. So
Your archiving ways allowed for our pal Johnny Jungle Guts to come over this
that's
week
right.
and watch Greg Araki's Nowhere,
Yes.
which came out in 1996 or 97,
Yeah, it was the third of his Teen Apocalypse trilogy.
and has never been on DVD to my
It
knowledge.
has not.
And based on having sat here at the desk doing work while he and his boyfriend Nehemiah watched the VHS tape that you have of it, I bet I know the reason. It's wall-to-wall soundtrack, and I bet they can't get all the music cleared.
Ah, that's
That's what
probably
I'm
it. Yeah.
guessing. Yeah.
So yeah, so it's good. These things, the closet gets full, but there's a reason to have this stuff sometimes.
Right.
Speaking of Netflix, by the way, two things or a few things to check out. The Assassin, I think we might have mentioned last week, is now
Yes.
available on Netflix.
Yeah.
A movie that was on my top 20 last year called Christmas Again is on Netflix, and it doesn't have to be the holidays to watch it.
Right.
It is set at Christmas time,
It
but
would help though, because it's kind of a bummer and it'll make you feel that good kind of depressed.
yeah, it's a good sad Christmas movie. I liked it a lot. I think it was a really great feature debut from a filmmaker whose name has flown out of my head, but it's I very highly recommend it, and I am the Christmas movie expert. And the big thing that's happening, all 13 or so hours of Jacques Rivette's
Out
Out
one.
One is on Netflix.
Yeah.
And so if you like binging on Netflix, here's a thing to binge on.
Why don't you tell people why you are the Christmas movie expert in case they're new to this show?
Sure. I wrote a book in 2010 called Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas.
From Limelight Edition.
Yes, and
That's a
come
real publisher, by
it
the
is, it is. And we are in that beautiful time of year that I like to call not Christmas,
Yeah.
when I'm not promoting my book. So we'll talk about that more later in the year.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, a lot of cool stuff popping up on Netflix this month with April starting out.
Got some letters.
Okay.
This is from Jacob. Hello, Dave and Alonzo. My name is Jacob. I'm 22 and live in Oakland, and I've been listening to the podcast for a few months now as I steam endless racks of clothes in the stockroom of my very boring retail job. I listen to several film-related podcasts, and Linoleum Knife has become the one I look forward to the most each week. Thank you, Jacob. Recently, I've been in need of distractions as I was broken up with,
Boo.
which feels terrible. I haven't even really had much motivation to watch films at the end of the day. However, tuning into Linoleum Knife at work instantly makes me feel better. Listening to you both talk to one another and to me is like having a nice chat with friends, discussing art and food with the occasional funny story to provide context that becomes an enormous tangent far from the core conversation. Branding. That's us.
I resemble that remark, as they say.
All of this I really enjoy, and all of this has encouraged me to watch a film tonight that my ex would most certainly hate. Yeah.
That'll show him.
Well, we don't know if this is
Or
a him.
her.
I now feel more confident that this guy was not for me. Okay, so it wasn't him. He made me buy a ticket to that dumbass Batman versus Superman nonsense. Oh, this is a recent breakup.
Wow. There's grounds right there.
Which he enjoyed for some reason. In return, I paid for us both to see a screening of Rebecca at the beautiful Paramount Theater in downtown Oakland, a very romantic and accessible film during which he fell asleep. Well,
Although you fell asleep when I took you to see Notorious,
yeah.
but it was a school night.
It was a school night. It happened. That used to happen to me on school nights because I had to get up at 5 a.m. and teach the next day.
Now you have to get up at 5 a.m. and not teach.
Right. We left early and things ended the following day. I hope I don't sound too bitter. I'm feeling much better now. Looking ahead, I can only hope to find something more like the connection the two of you share with one another.
Go.
It's a fact. We're role models of pretty much everything.
Heaven help the world. Oh. Aim higher.
Lastly, I'm happy to present 10 of my favorite films that would be sure to put my ex to sleep.
Aha.
For your consideration, let's knife them.
Sure.
All About My Mother.
Oh, the best.
See, you're just flattering Alonso Duralde right now with this choice. Just put any Almodovar in there, and he's all like, "Oh, my people!" You know.
Oh, shush.
Yeah, it's true.
It's not, no.
Talk to her.
Really? This is more or
Yeah,
less. Wow, okay.
them. Network,
Yeah.
The Piano, La Strada, Tarkovsky's Nostalgia.
Oh, so now he's buttering up Dave White.
I Am Love.
I believe it's nostalgia.
Whatever, dude. I'm American.
There's an H in there.
I know there is.
Solaris.
I Am Love.
Oh, yeah.
Chungking Express, which is just one of my favorite
Oh,
films of the
so
90s.
great.
2 Days, One Night, which
Yep,
is
our next commentary
our
track,
next Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episode.
which we had to do this month.
And Before Sunset.
Oh, wow.
You're 100% knife, Jacob.
And you are quite the romantic.
Well, there is that too.
So hopefully the next boyfriend will appreciate that.
This is from Daniel. Hi, guys. It is interesting that Manola Dargis continues to be controversial. I've gone from one extreme to a more centrist view on her. Back when she was writing for the LA Weekly, I really hated her.
Oh,
That's when I met her
yeah.
and was instantly in her thrall. It all started when she wrote that a movie, I can't remember which one, was a Bildungsroman in reverse. I didn't know the word, and this was before I had internet access, and the word wasn't in the paperback Webster's dictionary I've been carrying around since high school. So I had to go to the library to look it up. I remember telling a friend at the time she should start all her reviews by writing, "I have a master's degree."
Nothing wrong with knowing words.
Everyone should know all the words, or try to, anyway. It wasn't until she wrote her review of the soul-crushing Cat in the Hat movie in rhyming couplets. Do you remember when she did that?
That was genius.
That I started warming to her. I won't claim to love her, but I do enjoy her now. I love it when you have guests and when you don't.
Oh, well, thank
thanks.
You.
Thank you, Daniel. Glenn Gaylord.
Ah, who gave us the hashtag twerking on fleek Christmas ornament.
Hi, guys. I listened to your all-mail review and noticed you did not read my letter from 9/14/15. From 9/4/15. I have listened to every episode in between, and it wasn't read on any of them either. Do your diligence, Dave White.
By all means, read this letter.
Hang on. He's resent it. Hi, guys. Your podcast has saved my sanity on endless work commutes.
Oh.
I swear we did read this. This is just ringing a bell in my head, but we'll do it again, Glenn. It has consistently kept me from road raging at texting fools who either don't notice or don't care that the light has changed. So thanks for the endlessly entertaining, thought-provoking distraction. I look forward to every installment, especially when you disagree, such as the epic throwdowns you foisted upon each other when discussing American Ultra, a movie I loved hate-watching or hated-love-watching, depending on the moment. I have two questions for you. One, what are your top What Was I Thinking movies? You know, like that hot guy in high school you crushed on way back when, and now you're older and wiser and can see that he wasn't all that. I have two of them. You tell me yours.
So what, these are movies that we liked at the time?
Terrible films that we liked at the time.
The two that leap to mind, one was in college. It was National Lampoon's European Vacation.
Okay.
Which I saw with a packed house at it was a public sneak the week before it opened, and I thought it was hilarious. And then I dragged a friend of mine to see it in a nearly empty theater, and it just lay there like a dead fish. And then, do you remember a 90s French movie called, I think it was Savage Nights? It was one of the early AIDS movies.
Yeah, I do. I never saw it.
Romain Boringer was in it.
Yes.
I saw it the first time and loved it and thought it was really powerful and amazing. And then I saw it again about a year later and I thought, oh my God, this is junk. So yeah, it happens. What are yours?
Pay It Forward.
Wait, you had a moment of liking Pay It Forward?
Oh yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. You know why? I have a reason.
Okay.
My mom was visiting here. Mm-hmm. It was the one time she visited here before having her stroke. And I was having such a good time hanging out with my mom.
That it carried over.
And she went with me to the press screening.
I took her to see Dr. T and the women on that trip, if I recall.
And she was bawling at the end of the movie.
Huh.
And I thought, this is pretty sweet and lovely. Like, this is not a bad movie at all. This is really kind of nice. And I wrote a good review for it for iFilm. Mm. And then a couple months later, I was like, hey! The other one was What's the Worst That Could Happen? The terrible Martin Lawrence comedy.
That has the great William Fichtner performance in it.
Indeed it does. And so here are my reasons. I was super high on NyQuil when I watched it. I had a bad cold, but I had to go see it. And I had to review the film, and I was doing my best not to touch anyone, be near anyone. But I was all, you know, woozy on NyQuil. And so I was just laughing.
I said you were an easy touch for laughing.
Just laughing through the whole thing. Now, there was a good reason to laugh at some of it, because William Fichtner's performance in this film is legendary.
Yes.
And so astoundingly cool and genuinely funny that it sort of makes you want to like the rest of the movie more, but it's not a good movie at all.
No.
Yeah.
Pull daddy like a chariot. Does Glenn cop to any or
No. Here's the next question. Too many critics have overused the terms Hitchcockian and Hitchcockian and Kubrickian to describe directors who really haven't earned the title. For me, some have come close. Brian De Palma achieved woozy, dreamy Hitchcockian results with Dressed to Kill and Blowout, while Alain Giraudy's Stranger by the Lake nailed Hitchcock's shrewd, meticulous setups and quiet, tension-building point of view. Ruben Östlund, I feel, truly understands what made Kubrick tick with his coldly observant force majeure. I'd love to get your take on this and find out if you feel other filmmakers have even come closer to these masters.
Well, I mean, I think compositionally, Wes Anderson borrows a lot from Kubrick in terms of the symmetry,
Yeah.
but I think is a much more humane filmmaker than Kubrick. Stranger by the Lake is very Hitchcockian. I would argue that there's a certain Hitchcockian menace to Matt Sobel's Take Me to the River, which we talked about last week.
Yeah.
It's an easy adjective to throw around, unfortunately. And De Palma's Hitchcockianness, he's going for it a little flagrantly, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he is, you know, homaging as hard as he can
Yeah.
when he's in that mood, you know. I don't know. I try not to, you know. I mean, yeah, Stranger by the Lake and Take Me to the River. I think I compared both of those movies to Polanski, but I'm pretty tight with those adjectives. I don't toss them around.
I don't usually either, so I don't really have an answer for this.
I would say the force majeure. Yeah,
Other.
there's a connection to Kubrick, at least a sort of maybe approaching humanity from a bit of a remove, in a very sort of stylish but cold way. What were you gonna say?
Well, there's a filmmaker I really love from whom I believe Kubrick might have taken a little bit of influence from himself. So
Would that be
I this
Robert Resson?
we don't need to say his name.
Robert
But
Resson?
that distance let's just say that other folks were doing it before Stanley
And
Kubrick.
where did Brisson get it? Dryer?
No. No, he did not like Dreyer. No. He thought like in particular like
Oh, his Joan of Arc was intended as a rebuke.
yeah.
I see.
Yeah,
Okay.
yeah. So, here's this week's NOAA
No, the week would have collapsed
letter.
otherwise.
What's good, kids? I showed my younger brother The Bodyguard. I do not know what he thinks of it, nor does he, because he fell asleep. I did not fall asleep. I watched it for the second time. It still sucks, but it makes for a good Whitney Houston session. The Bodyguard has two of the best Whitney Houston songs I've ever heard in my life. I Will Always Love You. Hey, now. All right, Noah? Son? I Will Always Love You is a Dolly Parton song. Dolly Parton wrote that song in the 1960s. It is a song about Porter Wagoner, Waggoner. You should go Google him.
She sings it in the 1980 film Best Little Whorehouse in
She
Texas.
also sang it on the Porter Wagoner show
Yes.
before she left the Porter Wagoner show. They had history. Not a romantic one, my understanding is.
A professional one.
But a professional one. And that song was a big hit for Dolly Parton back then. Whitney Houston covered it. That is all.
I'm Every Woman is also a cover, by the
Yes. I Have Nothing, however, is on another level. That's a fact.
Yeah.
On the way to school this morning, I turned that on. with my new Beats by Dre headphones. Why are you telling us that your headphones are Beats by Dre? I don't think that's a bragging situation. And I couldn't stop listening to it. The bus driver turned around and urged me to stop singing. It was distracting him from driving.
Nothing. If I don't have you.
Anyway, what are your opinions on The Bodyguard? Bye. Love you, Dave. Alonzo.
The Bodyguard.
15 and a half. Taken, residing in Long Beach, California.
Well, Dave has more of a bodyguard story than I do. Mine is that Robert Abley and I, when we were living together, we had just moved to Los Angeles. It was Thanksgiving of 1992, and it was the day after Thanksgiving, and we went to see a movie that we'd been hearing really amazing stuff about called The Crying Game.
Right,
and it was great, and it blew me away. And this was back in a time when we were more frugal, and Robert always felt like if we paid to see one movie, we needed to leave having seen at least two of them.
Having stolen others.
Right.
You wouldn't download a butt.
That's right. But we did sneak into a movie. And the movie we snuck into was The Bodyguard. And all the deliciousness of The Crying Game got stomped out, and I had to leave the theater with the taste of The Bodyguard in my mouth instead.
Okay, so back in 1993, when I was in my 20s, I had a boyfriend. His name was and still is Les. Les's all-time favorite movie was Funny Girl. If I went to Les's house, Les had a VHS copy of Funny Girl playing. And I was at Les's house a lot. He talked about Funny Girl at least once per day. I think he watched it once per day. That's a long movie.
Yes.
He'd get up in the morning, he'd put in Funny Girl. He'd sing along while getting ready for work. He would pause it, go to work, come back, finish watching Funny Girl.
Don't tell him not to live, just sit and putter.
That is true. Do not tell him these things. So that was Les. But my nickname for Les was Bodyguard Les. Not simply because he was a giant, like, side of human meat, which he was, but because his favorite film of the moment, aside from Funny Girl, was that one. And he made me watch it on the same night that I made him watch Heathers. And when we were both done watching both movies, he said, I am never watching another movie that you pick again. He didn't like Heathers, to my memory. I, in turn, did not like The Bodyguard. But I Have Nothing is fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if you get a chance, pick up Dennis Hensley's book, Screening Party, which is very funny, and which has an entire chapter in which characters, some of whom may bear some resemblance to Dave White and myself, and Robert Abley, for that matter.
Ish, yeah.
Watch the Bodyguard.
Yeah.
And have funny things to say about it.
Yes. We're done.
We are done. Okay, so as always, we thank you for listening. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. We appreciate it. Go to Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia.com. Find out about his latest stuff, including his latest collaboration, Macaulay and Johnson. Go check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to the Rotten Tomatoes podcast with Gray and Matt, the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney, the Schmoes Know, the Joe Ryan Thing, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the Sewers of Paris, the Brett Easton Ellis podcast, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, Secretly Timid, the Game Night Guys. And If you've never listened to We Hate Movies, which is a podcast that I check out every so often, they just did an entire episode devoted to Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice. Usually they wait 10 years before they do a movie on their show, but they felt this was an emergency that they had to immediately discuss it. And it's hilarious. I highly recommend it. You can subscribe to this show for free at iTunes, and please leave us a review there. It does help people find the show. Follow us, like our Facebook page, stream the show at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast. Join our Patreon club. Support this program and get cool stuff, whether it's content or things you can wear or drink out of or carry around. There's lots of levels available, and we offer lots of fun stuff. And it's a great way to help us keep doing what we're doing. And that's at patreon.com/linoleumknife, one word. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions, comments, top 10 lists, anything else. And yeah, later on this month, we will be dropping our latest Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episode, in which we will be discussing the Dardenne Brothers, 2 Days, One Night, starring Marion Cotillard. And that's it. So have a good week, and we'll catch you guys next time.
Goodbye.